This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Healthcare is so overwhelming. My doctors rushed through visits. I was billed for things that should be covered, and no one was really listening. I felt lost. That's why I called Solace. They paired me with a trained healthcare advocate who actually knew how to get things done. She helped me find the right doctor, coordinate transportation after surgery, and overturn a medical bill. She even joined my appointments to make sure I got real answers. And the best part? It's covered by Medicare, and they stay with you for as long as you need help. My Solace advocate is always just a phone call or text away.
96% of patients report better care with a Solace advocate. That means better health outcomes, less stress, and finally feeling heard. See if you qualify at solacehealth.com. That's S-O-L-A-C-E health.com. Or call 888-7-SOLACE. 888-7-S-O-L-A-C-E. That's 888-7-SOLACE.
Don't face the healthcare system alone. Find Solace. Visit solacehealth.com today.
Are you ready to be inspired by the brilliant minds shaping the future of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics? I am your host, Kelly Shungu, and this is the Women in STEM podcast, recognized for its outstanding content and commitment to promoting diversity in the STEM field. Each episode of our award-winning show, we sit down with extraordinary people who are breaking barriers and making waves in the STEM field. From groundbreaking researchers to innovative entrepreneurs, we are amplifying the voices of the unheard. Whether you're a student considering a STEM career, a professional looking to advance, or simply curious about the exciting developments in this field, this is the podcast for you. We'll be exploring diverse career paths, discussing challenges and triumphs, and showcasing the incredible impact of women in STEM. Now let's dive into today's inspiring conversation. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Women in STEM podcast. Today, we're going to have a really interesting episode as we have not only one panel guest speaker, but we have three. I'm going to get them each to introduce themselves because they have very interesting job titles. And I think we can just go in alphabetical order.
Well, that's me first, I guess. Hi, Kelly. Thank you so much for having me or us on the podcast. So, yeah, my name is Antje Steinfurt, and I'm a conservation scientist with the RSPB. So I'm based here in Cambridge in the UK. However, my work actually focuses on the UK overseas territory of Tristan da Cunha. And because I think that many people don't know it's a territory, let alone where it is. So just quickly, so Tristan da Cunha is a small group of islands right in the middle of the South Atlantic, so halfway between South America and Southern Africa. And so I have been working in these islands since 2012. And yeah, they have been very much become home away from home. So I'm very excited to right now, but yeah, to continue my work there with the local partners and island community to help them sustainably protect and manage the incredible and very important biodiversity on these islands.
So I'll be next. I'm Louise Soans, and I'm a conservation scientist at the RSPB. And like Antje, I work in the UK overseas territories, but my work mainly supports science in the Caribbean overseas territories. So there's a bit more background to add to what Antje says for people who don't, for the listeners who don't know where or what the overseas territories are. And the UK actually has 14 of them, and they're spread across the Caribbean, the Atlantic, the Pacific, and in polar regions. They're mostly all small islands, But importantly, they're home to really, really globally important biodiversity. So most of the wider UK's biodiversity is actually in the UK overseas territories. So 94% of our biodiversity can be found in these small islands. But unfortunately, they're also that's where most of our threatened and endangered biodiversity also exists. So that's why we're working to protect and conserve that.
Hi everyone, my name is Natasha Constant. I'm a principal social scientist at RSPB. So I support a lot of our international programs in West Africa. And my work tends to focus a lot more on how people value and interact with nature, how na natural resources are being governed, and looking at the impact of conservation initiatives on communities. And much of my research takes place in the Greater Gola landscape in of Sierra Leone and Liberia in West Africa. And we work very closely with communities, local partners, and government agencies. So the Greater Gola landscape, it spans about 35,000 hectares of tropical forest and is home to a really impressive amount of biodiversity. So we've got like the white-necked kickfartes, which is an important bird species, chimpanzees, forest elephants, pangolins, and pygmy hippos. And then my work, I support a lot of work that we do with some of the forest edge communities outside of the national park. And we're doing a lot of work to encourage them to protect their forest on their community lands and also support them in the development of sustainable livelihoods that are forest friendly. And a lot of the work we do is helping to get community voices involved in decision making and planning for conservation, and also like evaluating the impacts of some of our programs too.
Thank you all for the wonderful introductions. You guys have a plethora of knowledge and you're coming from all the different parts of the world. So I think this is going to be a really interesting episode. I feel like before we get into each one of your career paths and what you guys have accomplished individually, I kind of actually just wanted to get a brief understanding of the industry. First off, I'm going to start off by asking you, Antigen, for somebody who's in who wants to get into a career field such as yourself, and they're looking into conservation science, where are the resources that they could utilize to find out about these different career paths? How can somebody get into this industry, essentially?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think, I mean, nowadays, like the yeah, social media and is an enormous help to you know to get to know like to follow professionals and or organizations, institutions, NGOs to see what they are doing and to you know even if you like search terms of engineering or conservation and you get a whole array of links there to where you can already like find out a lot about these. Yeah, or it's other channels like LinkedIn and so I think it's or if you know there are lots of seminars and workshops being offered across about variety again of institutions. So I think it's good to you know have an idea of what you want or like what you're interested in and then try to dig in a little bit deeper and find out where you know to get some information and don't shy away of you know contacting people and reaching out, trying to find mentors. And personally, to me, it's always, I always found it. So I did a lot of volunteer work as well to find out, you know, how different, what it entails to work in different fields. And yeah, because for me personally, it was always almost as important to know what I don't want that what I want. So to kind of, you know, try and shape your path and get us yeah start in the field or like figure out and then yeah follow your passion and figure out how to pursue a career in it.
Great, thanks for that answer. I'm coming to you next. I basically just wanted to get an understanding of what a typical day looks like for you. For somebody who might be interested in your career path, what do you actually do on a day, daily basis?
So it's quite varied. No day is the same as the next day. But at the moment, I would say I do quite a lot of project management, help to design and plan projects, plan data collection. Sometimes I can be in the field collecting the data, but often helping with the analysis and writing reports and papers. So our goal at RSPB is to support our local partners. They know their islands best, they know their species and habitats, they're the experts. So we're really here to support them in what they want to do in achieving their own conservation goals. So it can be really varied because it depends on what they want. And every island that we work in is different and it has different priorities as well. So hugely varied. So in any day, I could be looking at advising on management plans, protected area management plans. We could be planning a translocation and movement of endangered iguanas to safe havens on different islands. We could be looking at island restoration initiatives, rewilding, communications and education. It's really varied. There's so much to do. There's so many different aspects of conservation that you can't really say, "Well, this is what I do. This is the only thing I focus on." So that's what's really great, I think, for me. It's having such a varied role and being able to do a lot of different things, not just focus on one thing.
Wow, that sounds really, really interesting and intriguing how you're like you said, no days the same. You kind of have to expect the unexpected. On to you, Natasha. I wanted to know, in the essence of the Women in STEM podcast and the fact that we are not only wanting to inspire women in STEM, but also girls in STEM, how do you see your work helping to inspire the next generation of girls and women in science?
So for my work, I guess I tried to demonstrate that there are many valid ways to be a scientist in conservation, and we need social scientists as well as qualitative researchers and people who are comfortable working across disciplines and across cultures. And I kind of hope that communication of that helps broaden how young people imagine a career in STEM. And a lot of my experience has been through mentorship as well. So that's been quite central to supporting early career researchers, women, either through as a line manager or supporting students. I worked in academia for a while, doing some teaching and mentoring of students as well. And I guess a lot of that has been about how to support women in their future aspirations for their careers and helping to support their development and creating opportunities that align with those goals. So a lot of my experience has been helping create opportunities for leadership. So with grant applications or writing their first academic paper and being able to take a lead on it and help support them through that process and provide feedback. And then opening up networking opportunities. And one thing that I think is really important in this field is to develop a peer network of like-minded people and encouraging women to find that in their field. And I think there's a lot of really good kind of working groups and peer networks in specialist areas where you can volunteer or you can help be part of a group or organizing seminars and workshops and things. And those have been like really good opportunities for building your network, but also your support group as well. And that's really good for sharing ideas. And another one is really just trying to build confidence, you know, really building confidence and creating inclusive spaces in the workplace for women so that they've got a space to feel heard and to represent their knowledge and expertise as well.
That was a great response. Now I'm looking forward to kind of getting into the nitty-gritty of what you guys actually do. As you guys know, I'm a hardware engineer, so I'm hoping you can be able to break down some of what it is that you're achieving into like layman terms so that most people can understand, especially me myself. But I'm really, really interested in learning more. Antigen, I know that you have been your work has been to do with restoration projects and it's been expanding across multiple habitats and species, including the restoration of one of the world's most important sea life birds sites, as well as you're doing long-term work with penguins. Can you describe your role and how penguin conservation fits into the broader efforts?
Yeah, sure. So since 2023, I have been leading the long-term science and monitoring program on Gough Island. So Gough Island is part of the Tristan Island group. And yeah, even though it's only like the 65 square kilometer in size, so literally like a rock in the sea. And someone once told me it's the same size as the London Borough of Croydon, by the way. So it supports around 8 million seabirds of at least 22 species. And so many of them are endemic or near endemic to the island or the island group of Tristan da Cunha. So that means that you can't find them anywhere else than there. And so, and but another claim to fame to this island is that they are, what several of them are of global conservation concern, and including, I'm not sure if you heard of him, the critically endangered Tristan albatross. It's like this one of the biggest birds with this massive wingspan, and yeah, a true gentle giant. Anyway, so one of the biggest conservation challenges on this island has been invasive non-native mice, and so which are believed to have been introduced to the island by sealers and whalers in the 18th century, or 1800, sorry. And so they have caused ever since severe damage to the island flora and fauna, and particularly for the seabirds, they have impacted heavily the breeding success. So and our work, so the monitoring work we do on the island, so is embedded in the Gough Island Restoration Program and supports this program, which aim to re with, and this program aims to remove the mice from the island, and so to restore their habitat. And as you said, so the island is considered one of the world's most important seabird breeding sites. So it's really important work to do. And then, so I'm also RSPB's penguinologist in residence. So I have been studying penguins for over 20 years, and so they have definitely a special heart, a place in my heart. And so before I joined the RSPB, I already so I was based at the University of Cape Town in South Africa, and it was actually a project at the university on the northern rockhopper penguins that first took me to Tristan da Cunha. So that was back in 2012 now. So, and so the islands are home to over 90% of the penguins' global population. And I continued this work then once I started with the RSPB. And yeah, I do my best to help protect this very charismatic yet endangered species.
You've mentioned how your work has spanned over 2 decades. I essentially wanted to get an understanding of actually what first drew you to penguins and what has been your biggest conservation success or the most important lesson you've learned.
Yeah, that's nice. yeah, well, people often think that or imagine that it must have been a childhood dream or like a moment at the zoo where I like fell in love with penguins. But truth is that growing up in the country, like yeah, in the German countryside, I hardly thought about penguins as a child or teenager, really, and let alone I imagined that I ever would work with them. So it wasn't until I actually went to university and I met Dr. Rory Wilson. So he is one of the leading penguin biologists, and he gave a public lecture at the local aquarium, and I can't even pinpoint really what it was. And sometimes it feels a bit cheesy to say, but I'm not sure if it was the stories he told, the photos he showed, or something he said, but I was completely hooked. And so, and I think what specifically drew me to them, or I still drive me to them, that they are so often underrated. So penguins aren't just the fluffy, clumsy creatures we see in toys and cartoons. And I admire their deeply their resilience, their can-do attitude, like, you know, comes rains or shine. So if there's an obstacle in your way, then climb it. And I think what better lesson to learn from a penguin. And another Yeah, to say what I'm fascinated by is that anybody who has ever touched a penguin knows that they are not cuddly at all. So often I get asked like, oh, please cuddle a penguin for me. So no, they are really tough, powerful little muscle machines. And as awkward as they seem on land, as graceful are they in the water, flying through it at incredible speed. So that's when they're really in the element. And to your question about my proudest achievements, I think it's the contributions I made with my work to the designation of marine protected areas. So, for example, the establishment of no-take fishing zones around six of the largest African penguin colonies in South Africa. And this is just to halt the species collapse. So the African penguin is now, since last year, listed as critically endangered. And then work I did on the Northern Rockhopper also like contributed to the creation or went into the planning of the world's largest fully protected marine area around Tristan da Cunha. So like there was a decade of effort, and by the Tristan community, our partners, RSPB, and to like for over 90% of the island's waters are now, so that's three times the size of the UK actually. So it was declared a no-take zone in an effort to protect the waters around the islands. Yeah, I think that's.
That's amazing. And I love the fact that you're really dedicated to your craft and you've been doing this for quite some time. Moving on, I'm going to be talking to you next, Liz. I kind of wanted to get a better understanding of your work, and I know your work crosses low-lying hurricane-prone islands as well. How do you balance your biodiversity conservation with climate-smart approaches?
Yeah, thanks. So, yeah, working in the Caribbean, there's small islands that are often low-lying, and even though the Caribbean islands contribute very not they don't contribute much to overall greenhouse gas emissions and climate change, they actually are feeling the impacts the hardest. So they're getting stronger hurricanes, Category 5 hurricanes devastating the islands. They're getting droughts that last for months. They're getting huge storm surges, impacting their coastlines. So they're really, we talk a lot about climate change in the UK. We talk a lot, but I don't think we see the impacts as much as some of these places. They're seeing it every day, how climate change is affecting them. So when we talk about conserving biodiversity and protecting this area or protecting this species, we've got to weigh that up with the community that lives on the island, where a lot of the places Antje works are uninhabited islands. So it's a bit easier to do to get your conservation work done to protect the species because there's no one living there that you have to really think about. You have to obviously involve neighbouring islands and governments, but when you're dealing with communities living in the places where your threatened species or your threatened habitat is, you have to work with them. You have to make sure they're on board to ensure that the long-term success of any project. So really, you can't do biodiversity conservation and think about climate resilience separately. They go hand in hand. So when we're talking about the Caribbean, we're looking at healthy ecosystems like mangroves, coral reefs, wetlands. They're all there, and they can help protect the island from storm surge, flooding, and erosion. But at the same time, they're also really great for biodiversity. So it's recognizing the benefits to both kind of groups. So the way that we focus on this is a focus on nature-based solutions. So that's delivering benefits for conservation, but also communities, and that helps to get local communities on board and help them realize the benefits to them as well as the wildlife around them. So this could be some of our projects are focusing on restoring mangroves to buffer the coastlines against hurricanes, or reducing fishing pressure to help coral reefs recover and build, and that can help reduce wave impact when storms come in. So it's that kind of approach that we take. So it's about considering and integrating community livelihoods, food security, and resilience all at the same time. Not just saying we're out here, we're protecting this species of iguana. You have to do this. We have to think about it holistically, really.
It's really interesting. I really hadn't thought about all those different components and elements to your work. And I wanted to get an understanding of any advice you would give to women who are early career scientists. As you mentioned, there are some risks involved with regards to your work, and from my understanding, the industry is very male dominated in your line of work. So, what advice would you give them?
Yeah, so in terms of what I do, and maybe Ancho as well, we work a lot on uninhabited offshore islands or very remote places because that's where the biodiversity is that needs protecting. So there's fieldwork challenges. It's camping alone. You wouldn't go. You can't go to these places alone. If you're male or female, it's just not safe to do so. So you have to have a good team around you who know what they're doing, and that's why we always work with local partners. Wherever we go, wherever we work internationally, because they know the area, they know the culture, they know the society, they know the risks better than we can coming from the UK or another place. So the important thing there is to work, have really good relationships with local partner organizations, local NGOs, and we work very much with them rather than going out and doing anything on our own. So that would be the lesson there, I think.
Thank you for that insight. Now we're coming to you, last but not least, Natasha. I wanted to kind of find out with regards to your work and its focus on the human dimension of conservation. Can you share an example where local knowledge has changed your direction of your conservation project?
Yeah, sure. I'm actually going to give an example of some work in the Caribbean. So I worked with Louise as well on a project so a few years ago, and I think that was a really good example of this. So we worked on a project in the Turks and Caicos, which is an un which is in Caribbean, and we were working with the Turks and Caicos National Trust, which is our partner, and the Marine Conservation Society. And we were engaging island communities around their values, their visions, and knowledge of an uninhabited island, which is called East Caicos. And it's an important area for biodiversity, but it's well utilized by communities for fishing. And so we ran some workshops, and within those workshops, we used ma a mapping exercise. And maps are just a really great way to engage people because people can always identify with a map in some way. And we were interested in the community's knowledge, so how they were using the land of East Caicos and the seas around it. And it led to some really interesting discussions. So we learned a lot about the heritage values of the island and its history during sort of colonial times. But then we also looked at the community's relationship with plants in the area. So there's a lot of endemic plants on the island. So we were looking at how they were being used historically and in the present day. And then we learned a lot about from fishermen who attended the workshop about where they fish around the island, where the important mangroves and where the important reefs and their practices. So through these discussions, you get very rich information from communities. And we learned a significant amount of knowledge. So we knew a lot about the kind of biology of and the biodiversity side of the island, but not so much from how these communities, island communities, were using the space. So that's kind of an example of kind of local knowledge that we captured. And we were then hoping in the future that's going to be used in planning for conservation. But it was also feeding into, we had a lot of conversations around future visions for the island and what the aspirations were for communities for the future. And I wanted to mention some work that was done by our partner, the Marine Conservation Society. They have a method called the Community Voice Method, and they do interviews with different sectors of a community or stakeholders on an issue, and then they create a film. Then they get the community and stakeholders to watch the film, and then it kind of leads to further discussions. So you present different points of view. And again, we were using that as a kind of prompt to talk about future visions. So that's been a really exciting project. And the way it's kind of shifted direction was that RSPB were largely leading that project. And then over time, through the partnerships we've forged with the National Trust, we've got some amazing women who, Louise and I worked with, who are kind of at the forefront and taking this work forward. So a lot of I worked with a lady called Della Higgs, for example, who's the community sort of engagement manager, and she's just built up a really trustful working relationship with those communities. And we're hoping that they're taking forward this kind of community vision and developing a community council for talking about the future of East Cape Coast and its possible, whether it's going to be used for conservation or areas for livelihood development. So it has a lot of potential. But there's been a big shift in power. So RSPB are playing much more of a supportive role in this initiative, and it's become much more locally owned and much more grassroots. And there's a big enthusiasm for using some of the local knowledge to talk about the future in conversations. So that's just one example.
Thank you for that. That was a very thorough response, and I really like how you mentioned how you involved like the community, how it really helped shape the project. I also wanted to get some insight onto your career path. Basically, I wanted to get an understanding of how you actually got started in what you're currently doing.
My background wasn't linear. So I was actually trained in zoology with my undergraduate degree. So I had a really good, strong kind of foundation in the ecological and biological sciences. And then I realized that many conservation challenges fail not because of a lack of ecological knowledge or but because of human issues. And I took a bit of a pivot there. So during my postgraduate training, I did a PhD in anthropology, and I looked at issues around human wildlife conflict in South Africa. And it was through working with local communities that are at the coalface of wildlife and interacting with wildlife every day. So the issue I was looking at was how communities are affected by predators taking their livestock in rural farming areas. And well, talking to them and their experiences, I learned that people aren't just simply pressures on ecosystems, but they're active decision makers that have their own knowledge of the land and like very complex relations with nature. And in order for us to kind of move conservation challenges forward, we need to better understand like what motivates humans to act, more about their culture and their lived experience of working through different conservation conflicts. So that kind of led me into this kind of human interest in the human side of conservation. And I had some really good mentors, my PhD supervisors, Dr. Russell Hill and Dr. Sandra Bell, that encouraged me to look at an issue from an interdisciplinary perspective. And Sandra was an anthropologist, so I got exposed to a new subject, learning how people live, think, and relate to the world around them. And those mentors, I would say, they did challenge me to think about the world differently. So they encouraged me to ask better questions. They also showed me how to listen to people with empathy. And that's kind of the forefront of a lot of the work I do now, and to sort of challenge the status quo a bit. So that kind of combination of ecological and social training has moved me in this direction where I'm now working between science, society, and conservation practice. That's really kind of where I want to be at the moment. So, yeah, it's been an interesting path.
You've all had extremely interesting stories and interesting paths. We're kind of going to start wrapping up the episode, but one last question that I would like to ask you, and anybody can feel free to take this question. For anybody who's listening and has listened to your career path and feels like that's exactly what I want to do, what is one action that they could take before the end of the week that could help them with the trajectory of their career?
Yeah, I can. I'm happy to start. I think what I mentioned in the beginning too. So I would say this week, just try to reach out to someone like a professional in your field who inspires you, like whether it's a researcher, a conservationist, like engineer, or anything really in any field you're just interested in. And even a short chat over Zoom or an email, you can get a bit of a glimpse into their work, and it might open the door to, mentorship or help start building the network early on. That's what Natasha also referred to in the beginning. So I think that would be a good first step.
I would say maybe you can't do it by the end of the week, but I would say be brave and confident. So I've reviewed a few applicants, job applications of different for different roles within the RSPB and in the past, and it seems to me like males, there seems to be more males applying that maybe don't have all the desired qualifications and experiences, but they try anyway. It seems like they try anyway, and maybe it works out in the end. Whereas, well, for me at least, if I didn't have all the desired and things that the job asked for, I just say, oh, that's not for me, I wouldn't try. So I think it would be just try, apply for a course, an internship, a job. Even if you don't quite meet the qualifications, you never know what will happen. So.
Yeah, and I think I mentioned it earlier. I would say I really have benefited from that peer network, and to find out what kind of networks there are within your field. For example, in social science, the Society of Conservation Biology have a working group for social science, and they it's kind of free. You can sign up, and there's all kinds of you can volunteer on their council. They arrange conferences in this field. There's like mentoring opportunities and talks and things. And yeah, being part of that when you're young, I think, and building like a group of like-minded people is really good for exchanging ideas and just support, really, and looking at alternative career paths and engaging with people that are going through a kind of similar experience to you.
Great. Thank you all for your time and for your wonderful responses. Thank you so much for coming on the Women in STEM podcast.
Yeah,
Thank
thank
you.
you for having us.
Really enjoyed the conversation. Bye.
Okay, so I've come to the end and I'm about to stop the recording. Are you guys happy with the questions that I've asked you and your responses and everything? It was really good.
Yep,
There
I
was
am.
like a lot of knowledge, and I was trying my best to get through all the questions, and I think you guys did really well, so.
Listeners, if you've enjoyed this episode, please make sure to subscribe to this podcast on your favorite streaming platform, leave a review and rating to help us reach more listeners, and follow our social medias, the latest updates and behind the scene content. Join us next week for another exciting episode. And until then, keep exploring the world of STEM and empowering women in STEM.